as well as the role and goals of the British government in promoting Islamophobia.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fuelled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been considered deeply Islamophobic.
B spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay. The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified, seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy, because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology, and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from Jedburgh, and Head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajari, who's joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start with Yvonne Ridley in Jedburgh. Ms. Ridley, it's great to have you with us. It's been years since we last spoke. So demands for an independent inquiry into Britain's Trojan horse scandal have grown after this podcast recently highlighted several unanswered questions from the entire saga. So after so many years, why are there still so many unanswered questions?
Well, because as we've already heard in that excellent report by Robert Carter, that the whole Trojan horse affair was one big hoax. But it didn't stop the government and ministers like Michael Gove acting as though this was a very real threat. And as a result, decisions taken affected all of the state-funded education in England and Wales. And there was a McCarthy-style witch hunt. But instead of people looking for reds under the bed They were seeing Muslim extremists where there were none. Like all injustices, the Trojan horse affair cast a long shadow over Muslim communities. And the real losers were people like the one that we just heard, whose lives and careers were ruined by the Trojan horse affair. But also the long-term losers have been Muslim children in those schools, not just in Birmingham. This is right across England. I spoke to somebody today who was a school governor in Bradford who was edged out because people were seeing extremists everywhere where there were actually none. This whole affair has damaged people's lives, damaged careers, damaged the education in England and Wales. It's been very destructive. It's cast a very long shadow, and the government must be held to account. Good that the Muslim Council of Britain is calling for justice, but also ordinary members of the public have taken it upon themselves to sign a petition and try and force the issue to be debated in the House of Commons.
Masu Chajare, in 2017, the cases against the teachers collapsed, but their defense has never been heard to this day. Who should be responsible for this? Who should compensate, basically, the individuals that bore the brunt of this fabricated scenario? Despite numerous government reports, parliamentary hearings, and an array of legal processes, why has the truth been so hard to pin down?
Well, what was being accused was that the Muslim community or certain members of Muslim community are coordinating, organizing to take over the education and divert and brainwash the children, not just Muslim children, but children. But the reality was that the only people who were getting together to coerce and create a coordinated effort to do damage and do unlawful things was Mr. Gove and his colleagues. You know, he brought Peter Clark, which was the ex-head of the anti-terrorism of Metropolitan Police, with no expertise in trying to actually unleash whatever was happening or what was being accused within the schools. But his expertise was to always see a Muslim wrongdoers around the corner. And this is why he was brought in. I mean, it is very important to remind the viewers that what happened prior to this was these schools which were turned around. They were failing schools. They were turned around by this team of dedicated Muslims, not just for the Muslim children, but for everyone. So here was actually a solution to the problems of education in inner cities, which the Muslims rose up and start addressing. And actually, they were commanded for this. And then because of a fraud, someone took a position of writing a false letter. And everyone, Gove as a minister and indeed everybody else in authority, jumped on that bandwagon and demonized the whole of the Muslim community, disassociated Muslims for being involved in the future of the children, their children, and indeed other children. And that sort of process of helping the education within inner city, turning failing schools into actually a proper school, was totally lost to the Muslim children and indeed everybody else. And I would say that on top of the fact that we have to blame the institutionalized Islamophobia, which is definitely behind this, we also have to blame the Muslim community and Muslim community institutions because they failed to rise up and help and support not just these teachers, but stop the demonization of whole of the Muslim community. their failure at the time, it really is very worrying. When you compare the currently Sikh council sort of on the immigration bill, turning around to all the members of parliament and saying that anyone who's voted for this racist bill will be welcome to go into any of the temples, the Muslim councils actually failed miserably to support and indeed stand up against this institutional Islamophobia.
Ms. Ridley, you were nodding there when we were listening to Mr. Shajid. How do you perceive the role of the government in this scandal? And more importantly, what was the end result of it?
Well, I agreed with most of what Masood said, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community. The Muslims in Britain, ever since 9/11, have been put under the cosh. There's been paranoia displayed towards Muslims. Islamophobia has been fueled, and this race hate has really been directed at the Muslim community. Muslims back in that period, about a decade after 9/11, they felt under fire and had lost a lot of the confidence that they used to have. So when there was this deluge of criticism directed towards the schools about these Muslim fundamentalists creeping into the education system and trying to push extremist views onto the children, they just believed it. And, of course, it was one big lie pushed conveniently by Michael Gove, who was one of the most Islamophobic ministers in this government, a government which has a reputation these days for pushing out lies on an almost daily basis. But what is also important in this, while Michael Gove was pushing this, he also used this fake letter as an excuse to roll out some extreme counter-terrorism measures, such as the notorious, now discredited, Prevent strategy in schools, which turned every teacher, every teaching assistant, even parents into spies, which again undermined the confidence of the community.
Indeed.
You know, children were, any children that showed, say, support for Palestine were reported to the Prevent scheme. Millions of pounds was poured into this discredited scheme while the education budgets were creaking along and not able to perform. So there was a big domino effect in this, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community as a whole.
Okay, Mr. Shajara, you can also respond to that. That's exactly where I was going next. As a result of the government responded by implementing the so-called anti-terrorism prevent strategy in schools, it also made it a requirement for all schools to promote fundamental British values. Is religious intolerance being promoted in Britain?
Well, unfortunately, we know that this government, and indeed the rest of Europe, the governments, we are seeing sort of similar thing happening in France, Germany, and elsewhere. There is institutional Islamophobia, and the demonization of Muslim has become the norm. And we are in this environment of hate against Muslims. The problem is this, that, there is amnesia within those who are head of the so-called leadership of the Muslim community. And every time any incident happens, there seems to be somebody comes and push a button of reset button. And we forget about everything that has happened in past. And we're forgetting that we are living in this environment. And then we get letters from the the Muslim Council of writing to MPs and thanking them. I don't know for what, for the fact that they're not addressing the ever-increasing Islamophobia. And I, you know, we need to be extremely critical of this Islamophobic government, which is actually more Islamophobic than previous one, and there's no doubt about that. But at the same time, we need to actually be internally criticizing ourselves, because our institutions are not fit for purpose. They still want to rub shoulder, and they think that they get influence by having a cup of tea or rubbing shoulders with a minister or two. And I think, you know, Ivan knows this very well. I remember, Ivan, you raised that once in a meeting you were to one of the very senior police officers. You know this, I know this, and unless we tackle this, unless we actually stand up, when the situation is as bad as it is now, we need to be fit for that purpose. And that means we need to stand up, not just for protecting the Muslim community, which needs to be protected, but the whole community, because this environment of hate is so poisonous that actually affects everyone, Muslims and non-Muslims. See what happened in former Yugoslavia. See what has happened previously in other structures when these level of demonization have been unchecked.
Ms. Ridley, the effects of such such affairs, such sagas, they are all-encompassing. 8 years on, this Trojan horse affair remains perhaps the best known and most polarizing story about Britain's relationship with its Muslim citizens. What have the British public, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, learned from all of this?
Well, sadly, I would think that the majority of the British public outside of the Muslim community are not aware of this excellent Trojan Horse podcast, which has been produced by the New York Times. Why is it that this excellent piece of investigative journalism and great expose has come from America? Because it should have come from the British media. But unfortunately, the British media is also institutionally racist and Islamophobic. And, you know, this is where we have a problem. And what I would like to see the Muslim community do, not necessarily through the leadership of the MCB or any of these other Muslim organizations, is start to stand up. As I've often said, if you get up off your knees and stand up, the so-called great don't seem that great from that position. And so the Muslim community needs to get its confidence back. Maybe we should take a lead from the black communities in Brixton and in Toxteth. They got a lot of justice back through riots. I'm not suggesting Muslims rise up and take to the streets. We have other mechanisms and other ways of making our points known. But maybe we should take a zero tolerance lead from the black community and be vocal and be robust and demand our rights. You know, human rights are for everyone in Britain, not just a few. And so this is something that we need to get a confidence back in the Muslim sure. community. That's what we need.
Mr. Shajare, is the British mainstream media Islamophobic? Does it promote Islamophobia?
Yes, of course it does. They're promoting Islamophobia in many ways. The fact that this sort of story doesn't break out, the fact that, even when it breaks out, nobody is calling for resignation of Gove, which if it was, if the same treatment was dished out to any other community, they would have been called for resignation. And shrinking spaces, sort of 10, 20 years ago, a Muslim community as a whole had a more voice, a very diverse voice in the British media. Now it doesn't. And you know, now it's even sort of Zionists are speaking on behalf of the Muslims and everybody else, racist. So I actually agree with what Yvonne is saying. We need to be more confident in ourselves. The last conference, which was in January on Islamophobia conference, which we held, we looked at how we could work with the establishment. Should we work with them? Yes, no, maybe. And we looked at the historical, and indeed we looked at the experience of the black community, and we looked at it from a theological basis and everything. We need to revive the right of standing up to the bullies, because the bullies are taking over, and the government and the media are part of that bully.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests for the show tonight, Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from Jedbro, also head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajere, speaking to us from the British capital, London. And also a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, today we had yet again the opportunity to invite Dr. Karimi, who is a researcher on Islamic studies, who helps us to shed light on the narrations to understand better the concept of Mahdawiyyah. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, Dr. Karimi, we have been analyzing the chain of narrations which say that after Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his family, there will be 12 khalifs or 12 successors that will exist after Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his family. Then, who are these 12? This is the discussion. In Sunni books, we said that the number is definite, it is 12 in so many narrations. And then Prophet gives us so many hints. Even those hints are in the Sunni narrations. You discuss so many narrations from so many authentic books, which say that the number is 12, the lineage is from Quraysh, and then precised it more that the lineage is from Bani Hashim, and all will be divine, all will be respecting Islam. And then you discussed a verse which again says that Allah selects them, and they will be all infallible. Now, what conclusion do we get from all these narrations?
Sure. As you rightly mentioned, we refer to the fact that, first of all, the narrations about 12 Khalifa or 12 caliphs are mentioned in many Shia and Sunni sources. We said that the phrases are also different. We have 12 caliphs, we have 12 amirs, also 12 qayyim, 12 rajul, 12 guardians, 12 men, different phrases. But the point is that the number of 12 has been repeated in all these narrations. Now, who are these 12 people? We said that the Sunni scholars, they have tried a lot to figure out which people can be included, in this category of 12 people. But none of them has been able to do so, because if they're going to add the Umayyad caliphs, there are many more. If they want to add Abbasid caliph, the same problem occurs. If they want just to add the Abbasid and Umayyad caliphs, the number is less than 12. So they have not been able to give us any kind of true understanding of these narrations. For the Shia, the answer is very clear. These narrations are referring to the 12 Imams. Now, how this narration is related to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and how does it prove the existence
exactly
of Imam Mahdi? Again, as you rightly mentioned, some of the Sunni scholars, they have included Imam Mahdi alayhi salam to be one of these 12 imams, but to give a kind of argument, we said that there are this argument consists of the following premises. First, the number is only 12. Second, they are from Quraysh, and according to one version, they are from Banu Hashim. Third, the dignity and the greatness of Islam is dependent on them, which means that they might be very righteous, knowledgeable.
They cannot be oppressive.
Exactly. And the fourth is that they are likened to the leaders of Banu Israel. The point here is that the Nuqaba, the leaders of Banu Israel, were chosen by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and not by the people. So these 12 Khalifas should be also appointed by God and not by the people. And this is the viewpoint of Shia school of thought.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever.
The next point that I would like to mention in this program is that according to some of the versions of these narrations, these 12 caliphs should come one after the other. So we cannot mention that, for example, one of them is Imam Hadi alayhi salam in the first century after Hijra, the other one is that Abbasid caliph in the third century after Hijra, the other one is that Fatimid scholar, the other one, which the gap of like 1, 2, 3 centuries. No, this is not possible.
This is an answer to a very big question that may arise to people like, why do have we 12 imams from the same lineage?
Exactly.
Why don't we have like imams from different, why is there no gap? So this is even answer to two questions. And one more thing, an important thing rather, that as Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his family, rightly said that these 12 will be holding the flag of Islam. They'll be saving Islam mm-hmm. until Qiyamah, until the Day of Judgment. So if there is a gap, there is some corruption,
exactly.
The land will remain without any kind of Islamic government. They should be one after the other.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, this point, I mean, it's true what you mentioned, that لا يزار الإسلام عزيزا إلى 12 خليفة. Islam will continue to be dignified, honored, and firm through 12 caliphs, means that they will come one after the other. But there is an interesting narration in Kanzul Ummal by the famous Sunni scholar, Muttaqi al-Hindi, page 12, page 17. He says that لا يزال الدين قائما إلى 12 من قريش. The deen, the religion of Islam, would be firm and honored through 12 people from Quraysh. فَإِذَا هَلَكُوا مَاجَتِ الْأَرْضُ بِأَهْلَهَا. As soon as these people, passed away, there is no member of these 12 people on the earth, the earth would swallow up its inhabitants. So this notion has been mentioned in many Shia sources too, the fact that for the earth, for the creatures, for the creation to continue its existence, in each time we need a living imam. So this is a firm Shia belief. But interestingly, this has been mentioned by this Sunni scholar as well. So this is referring to the fact that in each time we need a member of these 12 khalifas and caliphs living among the people. So we cannot say that, okay, these 12 people consist of 6 people in the first century, 3 people in another, and there is no living khalifa from them. No, for any explanation, you need to say that in this time, this is the person that the Holy Prophet was referring to. One century ago, this is the person that the Holy Prophet meant. For the Shia, the answer is clear. For all the I mean, even days, even moments. For every moment, we have a living imam.
Right.
Before 260, the living imam was Imam Haskali alayhi salam. From that time onwards, the living imam is Imam Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance.
And this, again, clears one more question that we have, Sunni brothers have. They do. This is very interesting that they do consider Imam Mahdi to be among these caliphs, but at the same time, they do not believe that he is living.
Yeah. And that narration, which also is mentioned in both Shia and Sunni sources, that the one who passes away, وَلَمْ يَعْرِفْ إِمَامَ زَمَانِهِ, and he or she doesn't know the imam of his or her time,
will die ignorant.
Yeah, it is as if they have died at the time of the ignorance. Now, for every date, for every period, I mean, the question is that who is your imam al-zaman, the imam of your time? Again, for the Shia, the answer is clear.
And there's also one more verse in Surah Isra, which says that on the day of judgment, each one of you will be recognized with the imam. Like there will be groups like in this world, we are recognized by our name, by our date of birth, by our passports, by our identity cards. But on the day of judgment, we will be recognized by the imam that we have followed in this world. And that's really, really important. So that means we have to recognize imam. This is so interesting, like these verses and so many ahadith, like the rightly you mentioned, one of the famous narrations that says, if you do not recognize the imam of your time and you die ignorant.
Hold me by your hand and please show me the way to be one of the pure and chosen companions, so that I can swear the oath of allegiance. I'll give everything that I love in God's name to avenge the blood of your grandfather Hussein. Every step of the way, my dream will come true. On my last breath, oh Master, I'll call out to you. Oh Light of Allah, you are my true guide. I'm waiting for you to die by your side.
There is another narration referring to the fact that these 12 caliphs come one after the other, which is a very important point to prove the Shia viewpoint. This is from Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-Has, who said that سَيَلِي أَمْرَ هَذَهِ الْأُمَّةِ خُلَفَاء يَتَوَالُونَ. The Muslim nation will be led by caliphs who will come one after the other. يَتَوَالُونَ. So this concept of coming one after the other has been mentioned by in this narration too, which is mentioned by Al-Marwazi in Kitab al-Fitan, Volume 1, page 117. The next point is that, as we mentioned, the great Sunni scholars, they have mentioned that the last of these 12 people is a person whose name is Mahdi, like, and one of his names is like the name of the Prophet. And let me just share another narration from Yanabi al-Mawadda. Jabir says that the Holy Prophet said, Ana Sayyidun Nabiyin, I am the master of the prophets. Ali Sayyidul Wasiyin, Ali is the master of the vicegerents of the prophets. وَإِنَّ أَوْسِيَاءِ بَعْدِ إِثْنَا عَشَرْ. My vicegerents after me are 12. أَوَّلَهُمْ Ali, the first of them is Imam Ali alayhi salam. وَآخِرُهُمْ الْقَائِمْ الْمَهْدِ. The last of them is Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. May Allah hasten his reappearance.
Rabi'
al-Mawadda, Volume 3, page 291, written by a famous Sunni scholar. And just one last narration in this regard. Ibn Abbas says that the Holy Prophet said, إن خلفائي وأوصيائي وحجج الله على الخلق بعدي الإثنى عشر. My successors, my vicegerents, and the divine proofs over the people after me, they are 12. The first of them is Ali وآخرهم ولدي المهدي. The last of them is my son, Imam Mahdi عليه السلام. Then the Holy Prophet refers to some interesting points regarding the time that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will come. Like, فَيَنْزِلُ رُوحُ اللَّهِ عِيسَى بْنُ مَرْيَمْ فَيُسَلِّي خَلْفَ الْمَهْدِ. The Jesus alayhi salam, son of Mary, عِيسَى بْنُ مَرْيَمْ, will come and he will say his prayer behind Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Wow,
we know that this is a very,
famous.
Yeah, famous concept mentioned in many narrations, both Shia and Sunni. We believe that Jesus was not crucified, he is alive. But after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, he will join Imam Mahdi alayhi salam to help him. But who is the leader? Of course, the leader is Imam Mahdi, alayhi salam.
And this narration that is mentioned both in Shia school of thought and Sunni school of thought, that Jesus has not died. He was taken to skies, his soul. He's alive, basically. And it's very interesting. Our Sunni brothers do believe that Jesus could have that, long life, but Imam Mahdi cannot. Mm-hmm.
And it's not limited to him. You have the same about some other prophets as well, according to some narrations in both Sunni and Shia narrations. We have people like Idris as well, or Khiz, for example. According to some people and some narrations, they are also alive. So according to this narration, Jesus alayhi salam will come and say his prayer behind Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and then the Holy Prophet continues to talk about the time after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. This is mentioned in Yanabi' al-Mawadda, volume 3, page 295. So the conclusion is that all these points that we mentioned, all these narrations referring to the number of 12, the fact that in each time you should have one member of them who is
living
and who is a very knowledgeable and righteous. We cannot refer to, ordinary people, because the religion should be dignified and honored through these people.
He is the flag bearer of Islam.
Exactly. And all these indications just are in line with the viewpoint of Shia school of thought, which believe in 12 imams and the living imam, who is no one but Imam Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance.
Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us. Till then, this is Zainab with her whole team saying goodbye.
Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest rose? Please, oh please, please come.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Turkey has closed the passage of warships through its Straits of Bosphorus and Dardanelles. The decision was taken after Ankara called Russia's military action in Ukraine a war. President Erdogan said Turkey is using the authority given to it by the 1963 Montreux Convention Pact on passage of its straits to prevent the escalation of the Russia and Ukraine conflict.
Turkey is determined to use the authority given by the Montreux Convention on Turkish Straits in a manner to prevent escalation of the Russia-Ukraine crisis.
Erdogan said he was very saddened by Moscow's attack on its neighbor, describing the move as unacceptable, adding that Turkey will not abandon its ties with both Ukraine and Russia. The Turkish defense minister, in his turn, asked all sides to respect the international pact Turkey has worked by, assuring that it is Ankara's right to limit passage in the straits in wartime. Kiev had already asked Turkey to close its straits to the Russian warships. The move will prevent more Russian ships from reaching the Black Sea, from where it had launched attacks on Ukrainian southern coast. Analysts say Turkey's decision does not only help Ukraine but also Russia, as the decision prevents all warships, not only Russian ones, from crossing the straits.
Turkey is following a balanced policy between the two countries. The president already clearly stated that Ankara will not take side and stand with neither Russia nor Ukraine. However, enforcing the Motlux Convention is an international procedure, which will not affect Russia negatively, and Ukraine had already asked for it, hence Turkey will not be put in a position to choose sides. However, Turkey already rejects the Russian military action.
Turkey maintains good ties with both Russia and Ukraine, as it bought S-400 missiles from the first and sold the drones to the second, and does not seem willing to risk taking sides in this conflict. It seems that Turkey is trying to remain impartial in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, while it's trying to mediate to end the fight, with President Erdogan making some calls and pushing for a political solution. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Home Office has verified that the majority of people trying to reach the UK's shores via the English Channel are fleeing war and persecution. This comes in response to allegations made by the Home Secretary that the majority are illegitimate, in her own words, asylum shoppers.
If the laws that they're trying to put through Parliament at the present time, if they had been in process at the time that the present Home Secretary, Priti Patel, the time her family came as refugees and asylum seekers from Uganda, they would not have been allowed to come into the United Kingdom. Or if they did come into the United Kingdom, they would be put into some sort of detention camps that she is advocating.
The issue of Ukrainian refugees also got off to a rocky start, with the Home Secretary suggesting they could benefit from fruit picker visas. Now, under pressure, the government is offering emergency visas for those with family members already living in Britain. But at the same time, the government is pushing through legislation that will criminalise those coming from the Middle East and Africa, specifically via the English Channel, and people protesting this are getting mixed responses.
It's interesting that while we've been reporting here today, we have heard people pass by making some pretty off-colour remarks about refugees arriving here in this country. And that just confirms that there is a lack of sympathy here. And some would say those sentiments stem from misinformation, but most importantly, from racism.
White skin, blue eyes. They've said it on the media. White skin, blue eyes means you're acceptable. If you're brown-skinned or black-skinned, you're not acceptable. And it's a form of apartheid.
There are people who have been driven to suicide after arriving in Britain. There were actually more people dying after being in the hands of the Home Office here than the numbers that had been dying crossing the Channel. And that is crazy to think that the hope and the aspiration that drives a person to risk their life, the kind of Britain that they're hoping for, is the one we want to live in. But it's not the one we have. It's what we have is deeply driven, divided by racism.
The Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK extraordinary powers to criminalise, prosecute and imprison refugees, and give the Coast Guard immunity from prosecution if refugees die at sea. There have been widespread protests demanding this bill be scrapped, specifically now that the government is poised to issue hundreds of thousands of visas for Ukrainians, proving that when there's a will, there's a way. Bianca Rahimi, London.
British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's licence to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik, as well as their subsidiaries, will no longer be able to spread their lies to justify Putin's war and to sow division in our union.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship. And the European Union and the Western world in general
always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy, and that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing, because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
Palestinians in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets in support of more than 4,500 prisoners who are facing strict punitive measures and collective punishment by Israeli prison authorities. Recently, the prisoners have taken a series of actions against new restrictions imposed on them by Israeli authorities. Prisoners' advocacy groups who organized the protest described the prisoners' actions as an uprising or intifada.
I prefer to call it the prisoners' intifada or uprising, because the inmates face daily assault caused by the prison administration, who is seeking to destroy their collective efforts over the years that aim to improve living conditions in detention.
Tensions in Israeli prisons have escalated since September 2021, following the escape of six prisoners from the Gilboa High Security Jail. Although they were caught after a massive manhunt, Israeli officials implemented several punitive measures against the remaining detainees, such as banning visits and reducing their yard time, which led to clashes and strikes.
The prisoners are our red line. We will not allow prison authorities to cross it, and we will not remain silent on these punitive measures against our freedom fighters. And we know at the end of the day they will achieve victory as they did in previous battles. The prison administration knows very well what it's doing will only lead to more tension.
As part of those actions taken by the prisoners since January the 1st, some 500 detainees have been boycotting the Israeli military court system to protest their imprisonment under the so-called administrative detention. Today, some 4,500 Palestinians are held in Israeli prisons, including 180 children and 34 women. Palestinians hail them as freedom fighters.
Prisoners' advocacy groups say 2022 has been worse for the Palestinian prisoners so far, and the inmates themselves believe that they are in need of such solidarity protests because the worst is yet to come in the wake of the escalating tough measures by the Israeli prison authorities. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Following the recent retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army and its aerial strikes on Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, the United Nations Security Council imposed an arms embargo on Yemen's Ansarullah movement. This measure was proposed by the UAE in an attempt to curtail the military capabilities of the Yemeni army.
Arms embargo on Yemen is not new. As everyone knows, we are prohibited from even buying fuel, foodstuffs. Today, Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel crisis due to the seizure of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The Yemeni army depends on the Yemeni military industries, which have proven to the world the growing military capabilities of Yemen. This resolution will not stop the Yemeni missile attacks, but rather will prompt the Yemeni army to intensify its retaliatory operations.
In a Twitter post, the member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, criticized the measure, saying it has ignored war crimes by the Saudi-led coalition. He noted that any arms embargo that does not apply to the Western-backed coalition has no value.
The Security Council's resolution will not affect Yemen in facing the Saudi-led war. The Yemeni army continues to make progress on all battlefronts. And this measure is only aimed at satisfying Saudi Arabia and its allies. The resolution also aims to prolong the war on Yemen and halt any move toward peace. We, as the Yemeni people, are besieged. Our airports and ports are closed, and we cannot buy weapons like other countries. So this decision will not have any effect.
Saudi Arabia's allies have launched a deadly war on Yemen since the beginning of 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, many of them women and children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to escalate its retaliatory attacks against Saudi and Emirati territories.
Experts say the Yemeni army depends on local military industries in addition to the spoils of war left by the Saudi-led coalition's forces after escaping the battlefront. They believe that the UN resolution will make no difference as Yemen is besieged by Saudi Arabia since the beginning of the war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Images may soon be a thing of the past if Brussels has its way and removes Russian-backed media RT and Sputnik and their subsidiaries from the airwaves. British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's license to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship. And the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy. And that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that, really. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this massive disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
The Prophet of Mercy, a sequel to the 2015 letters written by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to the Western youth in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, imploring them to learn about the Muslim faith from its original sources.
And one of the key things in the book he talks about is education. And when you have education, you're able to talk to somebody, even if you don't agree with their point of view, but at least you can converse with them. And I think that with the lack of education, lack of respect for somebody else, or lack of understanding of somebody else's point of view, results in violence or results in people taking the law into their own hands. We don't want that.
Translated into multiple languages, the 196-page book elaborates on the life of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam.
I think the book is trying to say to us, we need to relook at his life in the manner looking at social cohesion, looking at the concept of brotherhood, looking at the concept of unity, looking at the concept of how we should resolve our problems together.
1400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and went on to change the course of history. For 1.5 billion Muslims, he is the last and greatest of that long line of prophets who have brought the Word of God to humanity. Today, Islam and its followers are on the receiving end of some of the most vicious attacks, all for the appalling acts of a few.
It is quite overt, and the paradox that Muslims are often accused of terrorism, whereas they're in fact amongst the prime victims of terrorism, because they do get attacked by fanatics and extremists all the time.
Prophet Muhammad laid the foundation for the religion of Islam that after his death developed a culture and civilization that spread around the world, inspiring hundreds of millions. At a time when many in the West, under the influence of the mainstream media, see Islam as a violent, intolerant faith, it is hoped that publications such as this one will shed light on true Islam and win hearts and minds. Saidpur is up, London.
He is referred to as the head of ambassadors in Iran. Salah al-Zawawi has retired after completing his 40th year as the Palestinian ambassador to Iran. He finished his tenure in January when he was succeeded by his daughter, Salam al-Zawawi. Here at the Tehran office of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the former Palestinian envoy was honored for his 4 decades of activities. Following the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran ended its alliance with Israel and officially recognized Palestine as a state. This was followed by shutting down the Israeli embassy in Tehran and turning it over to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Al-Zawawi was among a delegation headed by then PLO chief Yasser Arafat, who came to Iran days after the revolution and symbolically took over the keys of the embassy. Al-Zawawi is one of the founding members of Fatah political party and the second Palestinian ambassador to Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He has held the post since 1981. And before that, he served as the Palestinian ambassador to Algeria, Brazil, and Kenya. Throughout his career, Al-Zawawi took major steps to shed light on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which has been ongoing for more than 7 decades.
After 4 decades of serving as Palestine's envoy to Iran, Salah al-Zawawi is now retiring. But unlike any other ambassador, he's not going to live his retired life in his home country, as he's one of the millions of Palestinian diaspora who are denied the right to return to their homeland. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
If passed, the Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK government the power to jail asylum seekers for up to 4 years if they arrive via sea routes like the English Channel, and others could be sent to a third country for processing and detention. The devolved nations Scotland and Wales have already rejected it as an anti-refugee bill, and people on the streets of London are demanding Westminster do the same.
They're putting legislation in protest in place so that they can put guns on our beaches. That's what they want to do, because the migrants that will be coming when the climate and the ecological emergency really begins to hit, we want to welcome and they want to keep out.
Britain's banks, its military, its companies across the world creating poverty, creating destruction and warfare, and when people try to flee from the consequences of that, Britain puts up fences, borders, guards to keep people out.
The bill also gives the government extraordinary powers when it comes to ethnic minorities in the UK. A proposed rule change quietly added to the bill will give the Home Secretary draconian powers over immigrants, first, second and third generation alike. The fact of the matter is you can be born and bred legally in the UK, but if you have dual citizenship or can claim citizenship somewhere else, the British government might give itself permission to strip you of your British citizenship. In short, you're not British enough. You're a second-class citizen.
Once you are a citizen, you have the right to remain a citizen. I mean, there's many incidents. That young woman in Syria, that's such an important precedent. They groomed her. She should be brought home. She should be looked after. This is, in any other situation, this would be considered child abuse.
Shamima Begum was 15 years old when she left the UK for Syria, where she was absorbed by the Daesh terrorist group. As a second-generation Bangladeshi, she has been stripped of her citizenship and is still languishing in a Syrian refugee camp.
These are the most racist pieces of legislation.